Well, ladies and gentlemen, we want to welcome you to tonight's show. It's a voting rights show. So we're going to be talking about your right to have your civil servants working for your best interests. And I do notice from time to time that doesn't seem to be happening so much. I want to welcome you tonight to Progressive News Network and my co-host, Ms. Renee Shaker. Renee, hello.
Good evening.
Hey, I'll tell you what, we've got a heck of a show for you tonight. We've got Deirdre McNabb, president of the League of Women Voters. We have Susan Booker, Palm Beach County Supervisor of Elections. We have Ms. Samantha Hope Herring, vice chair of the Walton County DEC and state committee woman. Of course, we've got support from our sponsors at Legal Shield. And we've got the incomparable leader of Democrats who are progressive everywhere, Mr. Luis Cuevas, will be with us, and a special candidate guest, Ms. Corey Westbrook, who is a candidate for the legislature from the Vero Beach area. Well, and now the news. Ladies and gentlemen, more from our invisible radiation project over in Fukushima. They've detected the highest cesium levels in a year, over 1,780,000 becquerels per kilogram on a downtown roof. Radioactive cesium levels are found in moss on a rooftop in downtown Fukushima, exceeded 1.7 million becquerels, the highest level detected in a year, researchers said. Oroji Enomoto, an associate professor at the University of Tokyo's Institute of Cosmic Rays, measured the radioactive levels there June 8th of this year. A not-for-profit group based in the city confirmed the original results. Their test detected 1.78 million becquerels of cesium. Radiation levels of about 0.5 microsieverts per hour were also measured a meter above the moss. So all of you Fire Sign Theater friends remember that one. Officers and officials are aghast at the high levels of cesium detected far from Fukushima. Radioactivity is up sharply in wild mushrooms collected hundreds of kilometers away, over 2,000% increase in Tojishi. Tourist industry officials and restaurant operators have been aghast to learn that wild mushrooms picked from sites far from the nuclear disaster in Fukushima Prefecture are showing high levels of radioactive cesium. Last year, only wild mushrooms picked in Fukushima Prefecture were found to have cesium levels that exceeded legal standards. This year, however, wild mushrooms from as far away as Aomori, Nagano, and Shizuoka Prefecture, all more than 200 kilometers from Fukushima, have been found to be contaminated with cesium. Cesium levels have also risen in various areas compared to last year. By the way, 200 kilometers is 124 miles away. According to tests requested by the central government, the highest levels recorded this year were 120 becquerels in Aomori Prefecture, up from only 60 last year, doubling, 2,100 becquerels in Nagano Prefecture, 1,300 last year, and 3,000 becquerels in Tojishi Prefecture, up from, that's 3,000 becquerels, up from 134 last year. Obviously, the problem's over. They also said that, I don't want to explain why we can't provide mushrooms because we could lead to negative publicity that radiation is a major concern in Aomori, tourist officials said. Yes, let's not tell them the radiation level's high. It might screw with our tourists. EPA has abandoned the Wyoming fracking study. One more retreat. When the Environmental Protection Agency abruptly retreated on its multi-million dollar investigation into water contamination in a central Wyoming natural gas field last month, it shocked environmentalists and industry supporters alike. In 2011, the agency had issued a blockbuster draft report saying that the controversial practice of fracking was to blame for pollution of an aquifer deep below the town of Pavilion, Wyoming. The first time such a claim had been based on scientific analysis. The study drew heated criticism over its methodology and awaited a peer review that promised to settle the dispute. Now, the EPA will hand the study over to the state of Wyoming, whose research will be funded by Encana, the drilling company whose wells have caused the contamination. Well, that should be no problem. Industry advocates say the EPA's turnabout reflects an overdue recognition that it overreached on fracking by postponing the study. And environmentalists see an agency that is systematically disengaging from any research that could be received as questioning the safety of fracking or questioning the safety of oil drilling, even as President Obama lays out a plan to combat climate change that rests heavily on the use of natural gas. Over the past 15 months, they point out the EPA has closed an investigation into groundwater pollution in Dim Rock, Pennsylvania, saying the level of contamination was far below federal safety standards, no imminent danger, abandoning its claim that a driller in Parker County, Texas, was responsible for the methane gas bubbling up in residents' faucets, even though a geologist hired by the agency confirmed this finding, sharply revising downward a 2010 estimate showing that leaking gas from wells and pipelines was contributing to climate change, crediting better pollution controls by the drilling industry, even as other reports indicate the leaks may be larger than previously thought. They have failed to enforce a statutory ban on using diesel fuel in fracking. We're seeing a pattern of great concern, said Amy Moll. More information is available if you go to averyvoice.com. Averyvoice.com, you can see all the notes we're working from and the guest information. Averyvoice.com, A-V-E-R-Y, Avery Voice, V-O-I-C-E, averyvoice.com. Before fracking became the subject of high-stakes national debate, federal agencies appeared to be moving aggressively to settle whether the drilling technique was connected to mounting complaints of water pollution and health problems near well sites nationwide. As some states began to strengthen regulations, the federal government prepared to issue rules for how the wells would be fracked on lands it directly controlled. The EPA launched prominent scientific studies in Texas, Wyoming, and Pennsylvania, stepping into each case after residents voiced concerns that the state environmental agencies had not properly examined the problems. The EPA probe in Pavilion began in 2008 with the aim of determining whether the town's water was safe to drink. The area was first drilled in 1960 and the site of extensive natural gas development since the 1990s. Starting at about the same time, residents had complained of physical ailments, said their drinking water was black and tasted of chemicals. EPA conducted four rounds of sampling, first testing the water from more than 40 homes, later drilling two deep wells to test the water from layers of earth that chemicals from farming and old oil and gas waste pits were unlikely to reach. The sampling revealed oil, methane, arsenic, metals including copper and vanadium, as well as other compounds in shallow water wells. It also detected a trace of obscure compound linked to materials used in fracking called 2-butyl oxyethanol phosphate, 2-BEP. The deep well test showed benzene at 50 times the level that's considered safe for people, as well as phenols, another human carcinogen, acetone, toluene, naphthalene, traces of diesel fuel, which showed that man-made pollutants had found their way deep into cracks in the earth. In all, EPA detected 13 different compounds in the deep aquifer and said they were often used in hydraulic fracturing. More information is available on the site. Also, Britain has blocked the first crucial talks on intelligence and espionage between European officials and their American counterparts since the NSA surveillance scandal has erupted. Also, brief and wondrous life and half-life of the dangerous strontium-90. Though military authorities and officials from the U.S. Atomic Energy Commission initially downplayed the dispersal and dangers of fallout from these atmospheric tests, by the early 1950s, scientists in nuclear and non-nuclear countries alike began to raise concerns. Fallout from atomic tests, atmospheric tests, were not contained simply to the blast radius or a region near the explosion. Instead, the products of fission and unfissioned nuclear residue were essentially vaporized by the heat, carried up into the stratosphere, sweeping across the globe and eventually returning to Earth in precipitation. A host of radioactive isotopes contaminated land and surface water and entered the food chain through farms and dairies. The tale of the teeth. You're going to have to look at that online because I don't have time to do that. I want to leave you with a couple other thoughts. TEPCO, still the official operator of Fukushima Daiichi, revealed that it found strontium-90 in groundwater surrounding the crippled nuclear plant at very high levels. Between December 12, 2012 and May 2013, levels of strontium-90 increased over 100-fold. Hey, it's increasing to 1,000 becquerels per liter, 33 times the Japanese limit for radioactive isotopes. And remember, the numbers just keep on climbing. Samples taken from less than 100 feet from the coast. From that point, reporters say, water usually flows into the Pacific. Beyond concerns raised by the effects of the strontium-90 and the dangerously high amounts of tritium detected along with it, when the radioactive contamination enters the food chain, the rising levels of strontium-90 likely indicate other serious problems at Fukushima. Most obviously, there's little doubt now that TEPCO has failed to contain the contaminated water leaking from the damaged reactor buildings, contrary to the narrative preferred by company officials. And with that, good friends, ladies and gentlemen, I put you into the gentle hands of Miss Renee Shaker. Renee, take
Thank
it away.
Thank you, Rick. Thanks. Well, as we all know now, Tuesday, June 25th, was a very sad day indeed when the Supreme Court essentially gutted the Voting Rights Act. Now that we've had time to lick our wounds and assess the fallout, I thought I'd just take a couple minutes and look at what was done, what's left, and then bring on our guests to talk about this in greater detail. Fortunately, the court did not throw out Section 5 of the Voting Rights Act, which, as we know, is really the meat of the act in that it requires counties and states that have a history of voter discrimination to get preclearance from the Justice Department anytime it wants to make a change in voting, whether it's voter ID laws or a change in polling places and so forth. But what the court did throw out and ruled unconstitutional was Section 4. And Section 4 is the formula that the government uses to determine which communities, counties, and voting districts are subject to Section 5. The act was renewed a number of years ago, but Congress did not touch the formula used in Section 4, which was determined first back in 1968 and then 1972. So by throwing out the formula, of course, Section 5 remains gutted. But there are other sections of the Voting Rights Act which we can still look to with some measure of hope. For instance, the Justice Department can still use Section 3 of the Act to get states or cities back into its jurisdiction, allowing it to judge election changes. To do so, it must show clear intent of racial discrimination, which unfortunately is very easy to hide. There's also Section 2 of the Act, which gives the department and private citizens the right to sue any local or state government for an improper election practice. These kinds of illegal actions, though expensive and difficult, are likely to become the principal tool for enforcing voting rights in the wake of the Supreme Court action, and the department needs to gear up to fight many more of them. We have many organizations who've been on the front lines, particularly in this last election, who've been fighting these battles. Now we need to support them even more. The day after the court's decision, in fact, a group of Black and Hispanic Texas residents filed a Section 2 law in Corpus Christi to stop the state's revised voter ID law. Texas was one of five states that triumphantly used the Supreme Court's decision to move ahead on ID requirements that had previously been blocked. Unfortunately, the Texas ID law, one of the most onerous in the country, requires residents to travel up to 250 miles at their own expense to get these voter IDs. Congress has the power to make these suits easier to file. For one way, for example, would be to allow plaintiffs to show that a practice diminishes minority voting rights, a standard in the now paralyzed Section 5. Congress can still make Section 5 usable with new rules for inclusion. For example, it could require preclearance for any state found to have violated a federal election law in the last few years, which would, not surprisingly, include most of the southern states, along with many others. At a minimum, all states and localities should be required to disclose on the Internet any voting change, allowing citizens and Washington a chance to raise concerns and comments. The most fundamental change Congress could make would be a law declaring a universal right to vote that could not be infringed on by any level of government. The Voting Rights Act was aimed at combating discrimination on account of race or color, which was the urgent problem of the time. Discrimination, unfortunately, has now broadened to encompass more groups of different kinds, and it is time for a broader law, especially given the Supreme Court's clear intent to dismantle all racial protections. We'll see. Is this liberal fantasy? It was encouraging last week to hear several House Republicans, including Majority Leader Eric Cantor, say they were interested in restoring protections to voting. One of them, James Sensenbrenner, Jr. of Wisconsin, put the challenge, well, this is going to take time and will require members from both sides of the aisle to put partisan politics aside and ensure America's most sacred right is protected. Unfortunately, this is not the first time the Supreme Court has taken a shot at voting rights in this country. Back in 2004, it ruled in an important case in Pennsylvania that gerrymandering, because it's been a fact of life in this country, should not be stopped. They basically did not find any reason to consider this a political overstep and basically took away an aggrieved person's rights to challenge gerrymandering. And then, of course, back in 2010, we have the now infamous Citizens United decision, which opened the floodgates of money into political elections. And a little research that I was doing, Rick, showed that outside spending by super PACs in the last election soared to $1.3 billion. That's a piece of pocket change.
Wow.
Yeah. So we have a number of guests that are coming on that are going to talk about this in more detail and tell us what they're doing. In the meantime, Rick, until our first guests come on, do you have more news for us?
Oh, my goodness gracious me. Yes, indeed. You've all heard, I'm sure, about the leakage in Hanford. Well, don't you worry. The EPA has slapped the little wrist of our good friends in the Department of Energy. They fined them $136,000. That's right. $136,000. And all they did, you know, all they did was they operated a waste storage area without a required permit. They stopped using other areas for storage without closing them or requesting an extension. And in their spare time, they didn't properly treat the waste. But other than that, it's no big deal. Hundreds of inspections during the almost two decades have not raised issues with methods now being criticized, they said. So if we used to get away with this, why are you hassling us now? Said the Department of Energy. However, the EPA's National Enforcement Investigation Center conducted an inspection back in March 2011 and questioned whether they were doing it right back then, and they even have the permits. So, gee, things have really improved there. By the way, DOE had permits to store waste in units within the T plant, some double-line trenches in the Central Waste Complex, but it was also storing waste in places in those facilities that the permits didn't cover. But ladies and gentlemen, I've got good news for you. We've got our first guest, Renee. I think I'd like to introduce Ms. Deidre McNabb, President of the League of Women Voters. Welcome, Deidre.
Good evening, Rick, and good evening, Renee. It's a pleasure to be with you and all your guests tonight. Thank you very much.
Good evening, Deidre. Thank you so much for joining us. We know the League has been out there on the front lines in this whole issue of voting rights, and I know your organization is probably still coming to grips with the Supreme Court decision, but you guys have been working on a much broader front, and I understand that you've got a project going on redistricting, and you also have a recent court victory. Why don't you tell us some more about those?
Thank you, Renee, and it would be a pleasure to do that. I do, however, want to make a shameless request of those listening, and that is to get involved. whichever organization you decide to join and get involved in as a more active citizen. I hope you'll like the Florida League's Facebook page, which is the League of Women Voters of Florida, and our website is thefloridavoter.org. The Supreme Court decision was really quite extraordinary. I can tell you here in Florida, we wondered if some of the justices had been reading the news about what happened in Florida. I don't think there's a person in the country who hadn't seen at least one late night talk show comedy which made fun of the state of Florida in terms of, which by the way was not fun at all if you were waiting on the line, but up to 8 hours in parts of the state. And I know a lot of listeners tonight are from the southern part of Florida where we had some of the longest lines. And of course, 4 days to figure out which presidential candidate had won in the state of Florida. So very clearly, we have problems here in the state of Florida and many of the other southern states. So we're very concerned about the Supreme Court decision. With that, however, I will talk briefly about the two battles that we have, one we are still in and the other one we are now watching closely, and that's the elections. The third districting is an issue which is so really integrally important to good government, but, you know, people say fair districts, what does that mean? What is that about? It's interesting to know that Florida had one of the highest rates of reelected incumbents. It was in the neighborhood of 98% of incumbents were reelected in the state of Florida. And we also had one of the nation's highest numbers of non-competitive races. Well, why should people care about that? Clearly, if you live in a part of Florida where there is a non-competitive race, it means that the people who are representing you in Tallahassee or in Congress don't really care what you think because they don't have to. They have nobody running against them. That's why the Fair Districts Amendments were so important. The League worked very closely with other groups in the state. It was a very effective coalition effort. We were able to get it on the ballot, and a wonderful 63% of Floridians voted for it, and it is now in our Constitution. Unfortunately, the legislature still draws the districts. So what do legislators do? They draw districts as much as they can to make sure they continue to be reelected. And we are still, the League of Women Voters is still on this battle. We have two lawsuits pending, one where we are saying that the legislature did not follow the rules when they drew the congressional maps for Florida, and one where we are saying they did not follow the rules when they drew the Senate maps. So those two court cases are pending. They are active, and that battle is not over until the legislature understands that when the people of Florida spoke in the voting booth, they meant it. And so we are excited about that. That's a big step forward for Florida. I think many other states are watching to see how this develops. But the bottom line is it means that people across the state of Florida will have more competitive elections and that their elected officials, importantly, will be thinking about how their voters think about them. Just an interesting side note, we had Mayor Bloomberg from New York came down during this entire effort 2 years ago and gave roughly $250,000 of his own funds. He said that it is shameful for democracy when elections are run like the worldwide wrestling and matches are predetermined. And he said, when you get this done in Florida, come up to New York and help us get similar redistricting requirements in our state constitution. So this is a very, very important issue. Yes.
Let me ask you a quick question. The legislature seemingly went out of its way to constrain people who collect people who sign up voters. I was wondering, did you think that that was designed specially with League of Women Voters in mind?
Well, I would say not specifically the League of Women Voters. I would say a number of groups, because there are a number of groups, and the League of Women Voters is perhaps one of the oldest groups who has done third-party voter registration, but also groups like the NAACP, many Hispanic groups, the Boy Scouts who have reached out through history to groups that have more difficulty getting registered and rely more heavily. So yes, the answer is it has a big it had a big impact on our group, but of course there were other groups as well that were severely impacted, and I'm delighted to say that the court overthrew almost all of those restrictions and said it was unfair and undemocratic to put those kinds of unnecessary obstacles in place.
Well, I want to thank you as a part of the League of Women Voters for taking the trouble to take it to court, because you were defending voters, and there's nothing more democratic in this country, I think, than defending voters. Thank you.
Deirdre, could you could you tell us a little bit about the specific mechanics of the fair districting for those that aren't as involved in this? How does that work?
Well, the new amendments in the Constitution are very simple and straightforward, and they basically say, and I'm paraphrasing because I don't have them in front of me, but basically what they say is that districts cannot be drawn for the purposes of benefiting an incumbent or a political party, and that districts should be as equal in number as possible, should follow existing geographic boundaries, such as cities and counties, and should follow the national voting rights laws, which protect the rights of our minority voters. Very simple, very straightforward, and the amendments stipulated that for both congressional and for legislative, and that's why there were two separate amendments.
What about the notion of taking redistricting out of the hands of politicians and putting it in, say, an independent commission like some other states have done or are contemplating? Is that something that would work here?
Yeah. Well, it is, interestingly, this was our fourth effort to get this issue on the ballot, and in a previous petition effort, we did try to get a separate independent election commission set up, and that is, in fact, the way California does it, and they are still new to this process, so we are watching with great interest. The difficulty with including that as part of the amendments was that we have a requirement in the state of Florida that when citizens put a ballot initiative forward, it must be single subject. So we were already circulating two petitions and getting more than 600,000 for each signatures. This would have required four different petitions. So you can imagine trying to secure the patience of a petition signer and say, oh, we've got four things here for you to sign. So that may be something we go back to at another time, but we did feel that the first most important step was to have clear standards, because in the past when we've gone to the courts had said, I'm sorry, there really are fundamentally no rules for how districts are drawn, so you have nothing really to sue on. Now we have clear standards in place that require fairness and equity, and something that the legislature has to follow. We're seeing that they're doing their darndest not to, but thank goodness we have the courts in our country as a resource, and we believe strongly in the fairness and the impartiality of that.
I know in my own work in the last campaign, one of the issues we were talking to voters about were the judges and how vital it was to not let our governor reshuffle the judgeships to be able to take more control of these sorts of processes. So I think that the League's work in getting the word out on that issue was also very important, no?
Renee, absolutely. You know, the balance of power is one of the most important components of a strong republic and government that we have in America. And I think sometimes those of us who live in the state of Florida feel like we live in a state that's a petri dish for bad legislative ideas. Speaker Cannon, when he was the Speaker of the House 2 years ago, came up with the idea of splitting the Supreme Court in two. which is an idea that has only been tried in one other state, in Texas, and not with any measure of success. He was not able to persuade the legislature, thank goodness, to put that on the ballot, but they came up with a number of other bad ideas that would really slant the power of the judiciary toward either the governor or the Florida Senate. We worked very hard to educate Floridians on, it was Amendment 5, and those listening on the phone from the state of Florida, we had 11 amendments on the ballot, and anybody who voted that ballot can remember it was probably like taking the SATs or the FCAT for Florida students. Very complicated constitutional language. Thank goodness the voters of Florida turned it down. Interestingly, the Amendment 5, which would have skewed the independence of the judiciary, got the highest no vote by citizens of all the amendments. And similarly, in other states where amendments like that were put on the ballot, they were all turned down. So what that tells us is American voters are very sensitive and aware of the importance of an independent judiciary, and efforts by legislatures across the country like Florida will not be tolerated. Hopefully that will be a wake-up call for our legislature, and we will certainly be there to remind them should they decide to continue in the effort to dismantle the independence of our judiciary.
Well, bravo on that and much more of the work that you're doing. And as we look ahead going into the next election season, what are the issues that the league is focusing on, and what are some of the issues that our audience should be aware of?
Well, I think number one is our antennae are way up in the area of election reform, and immediately following the federal Supreme Court's decision on voting rights, we saw a number of states go forward with some really voter suppression type ideas, including the voter ID issue in Texas. To be honest, we are not really anticipating that the legislature would have the hubris to try and pass a voter suppression bill next year, but it is very likely that they may try in future years, and we will be watching very closely. And you know, they got a national spanking in the media with the Florida election in November 2012, so we are hopeful that they did pass, we thought, a very respectful election reform bill this past session to fix many of those issues, and I particularly want to call out Senator Jack Latvala and Representative Jim Boyd, who did a very good job there. The other issue that we're following and very interested in is the issue of Medicaid expansion. We think it is critically important for the state of Florida and other states to accept that money. If they don't, we will have the country's working poor uncovered for health insurance. Not having health insurance is the single biggest reason for bankruptcy and mortgage default. And also, we had a conference call, it was just 2 weeks ago, with some business consultants, and they expressed the bottom line is for states who don't take that Medicaid expansion money from the federal government, the rest of us will pay more, businesses will pay more, and they projected it could cost as much as 30% because somebody has to pay for those medical expenses. So we will be pushing hard in the state of Florida for the state to take the Medicaid expansion money. We have seen some of the other Republican states, and again, Governor Jan Brewer, who's been very conservative Republican, was insistent that the state of Arizona take that Medicaid expansion money. So there are some examples that we have seen in other states with Republican majorities, and we will continue that push very, very hard.
Well, I certainly wish you all the best on that. That was a very disappointing issue coming out of the last legislative session. Is there any reason that we can be more hopeful on that you see?
Well, I'm an eternal optimist, and I think that the people are going to begin to wake up. You know, the October 1st is coming up in just a matter of days now, and that is when Floridians and people across the United States will be signing up and looking at the new insurance exchange. This is not a perfect program, but it's a giant leap forward in providing health care to Americans. And we are going to need to work together as a country to move forward, to get people signed up, and to encourage states to take the Medicaid expansion funds to cover the working poor in this country. And Florida has one of the largest numbers of working poor because our economy relies so heavily on really low-income industries, farming, tourism, and construction. So these are people who work all around us. They work every day. Probably many people listening on the phone may be uninsured. And we believe once it kicks into place, which it will January 1st of 2014, the pressure will mount higher and higher. And it is going to take concerned citizens like those who are on the line tonight to continue to push this issue and make sure their congresspeople, their state legislators know that the people of this country believe the time has come Americans should get health care coverage.
Deirdre, thank you so much. I know you had a very busy schedule, and this has been really great that you were able to fit us in. Why don't you go ahead and give our listeners your contact information one more time?
Thank you. The Facebook page is League of Women Voters of Florida. And our website, where you can sign up to get all our emails and press releases, is thefloridavoter.org, thefloridavoter.org, as well as action alerts. So we make it as easy as possible for you to let your elected officials know where you stand. And I just want to thank, I know on this line tonight, we have very active citizens. I like to call them citizen gladiators. And that is what makes our government strong, is the attention and the everyday awareness and participation of active citizens. So thank you very much for having me tonight, Renee.
Thank
Rick.
You.
Thank you,
very
Deirdre.
Much.
Good night. Thank you.
Good night.
Bye-bye.
Bye.
Okay. That was Ms. Deirdre McNabb, President, League of Women Voters. Thank you so much, Ms. McNabb, for your time. Now we want to mention that there's a wonderful group of other progressive broadcasters out there. We always want to mention them so that when you're not tuning into us, you can tune into them. For example, Ms. Gwen Holden Berry and her show, Here Be Monsters, which is on the hour before us here. Brian Stetton and his show, Progress Toward Democracy. It's Monday and Friday evenings at 10 o'clock. Sita Baguil and her show, Sita Media. Anita Stewart and her show, Wise Women Media. Susan Nylon and the Nylon Report. It's on every afternoon out of the Sarasota area. Emily Dillick and her project, The Progressive Press, an online, wonderful press online. And Miss Harriet Lehrman and her show, The Voice. So that was wonderful. And now we've got a wonderful interview we did with Miss Susan Booker, the Supervisor of Elections for Palm Beach County. And here we go, Miss Susan. Supervisor of Elections. Welcome, Ms. Booker.
Good morning. How are you?
Very good. Very good. And yourself?
I'm very good. Thank you.
You know, Ms. Booker, it is such an honor to have you here. You are the person that protects the integrity of the votes in Palm Beach County. You have such responsibility in your hands. It is such important work for democracy. I can't thank you enough and appreciate you taking a few minutes to be with us.
Well, I really appreciate the work that you're doing as well. It helps a lot to inform our voters of what's going on, not only, you know, in our county and statewide, but nationally. There's been a tremendous impact with the recent ruling on the Supreme Court about the Voter Rights Act. And
what?
I'm hoping that that's what we can talk about today.
I wish you would. Go ahead, Ms. Booker.
Well, you know, just about a week and a half ago, the Supreme Court provided a decision, and it struck down the 1965 Voter Rights Act that's been in place and has been renewed in a bipartisan manner, most recently in 2006. And during that vote, it was a bipartisan vote. In the House, it was 390-3, and in the Senate, it was 98-0 to extend the Voting Rights Act with a Republican-controlled legislators in 2006. They believed that discrimination still existed, and this law covered certain territories that were proven to have discrimination for voters in the past. Unfortunately, the Supreme Court decided that there's a Section 4, and it provided the impetus for people to challenge unusual voting laws that would go in place to try and disenfranchise some of our voters. And that was some provisions that provided protection up front before this would occur. Unfortunately, the Supreme Court decided that the data, the information that was used to reauthorize that act, is outdated. But they did acknowledge that discrimination still exists. In fact, John Roberts, Supreme Court Justice, he's the Chief Justice, said that he believed that discrimination in voting is a real threat and continues to exist. What he decided is that discrimination today looks markedly different from what it did decades ago, so he indicated that the law had to be updated by Congress. And so, unfortunately, we've heard very little from Congress about restarting that process. You know, what I think he really meant to say is that, you know, in the past there were blatant attempts to stop people from voting, police activity at the polls, lots of different things, you know, turning people away unusually. And I think what they're talking about is today what we're seeing is these laws, these very thinly veiled laws, for instance, they passed in 2011 in the state of Florida to decrease the voter turnout. And so I think we'll find ample information if Congress takes this up real quickly to take a look at the decision that the Supreme Court provided and work on providing some updated data. I think part of the data comes from the state of Florida, decreasing early voting to in half, providing only constrained facilities for early voting, making people vote by provisional ballots. You know, there's a lot of activity that happened in 2011. But I'm pleased to say that, you know, through public pressure and through media like yourself and others, the legislature substantially amended those 2011 laws this year in 2013, and it will bring back the full 14 days of early voting at the discretion of the supervisor, and also at the discretion of supervisors is to reinstate the final Sunday voting that's traditionally known as souls to the polls, which impacts a lot of African American communities.
Well, I'd like to hope that we won't see the voter purges and those kind of adventures that we've seen too often, and not just here. And we still have these onerous voter ID laws. But that being said, I'll be happy to take your slightly more positive take on the Supreme Court than maybe some of us have.
all we have. There is another provision by which these laws, you know, within hours, there were numerous states that said, you know, yippee, the preclearance or the jurisdiction of the Department of Justice is gone, and they swiftly intended to change laws that had been stopped by the federal courts and the Department of Justice. So we're really hoping that Congress will hurry up and pick this action up as quickly as possible. And I'll tell you, here in the state of Florida, there were attempts to purge voters. You know, fortunately, I know the law exceedingly well, and the determination is that of the supervisor of elections. And I was the supervisor to say, no, your data is almost 12 years old. We're not going to purge our voters. You need to prove beyond a credible doubt that these are voters that we should take off our rolls. The state was unable to do that, and the purge was discontinued.
Well, you know, that is a remarkable thing. You and several other supervisors of elections stood up to this clearly bogus attempt to constrain voting again. And you also were telling me that you have some other good news in terms of being able to get equipment out in the field.
Well, we do. You know, this is the first time I've had any time off without elections in the 4 years that I've been the supervisor. And what we're working on is some new technology. Some very simple off-the-shelf technology will allow us to move voters through in a faster pace. We actually are working on some mini iPads right off the shelf. And those iPads can take a picture of the QR code, the little squiggly code on the backside of your driver's license. It'll populate your voter information. You'll sign that mini iPad. It'll send a message to our database to say that you're voting, and it will print you a ballot so that we can move you through quicker. We also lobbied the legislature and were successful in getting to go to larger locations for early voting. Right now, the law, before they changed it, and what was in effect in 2012 only allowed us to go to libraries and city halls and our offices for early voting facilities. Well, what we found is these were all constrained facilities, and we couldn't put more than two ballot printers in there without blowing breakers. So now we can go to places like stadiums, convention centers, fairgrounds, community centers, senior centers. And what we're working on now is to provide additional ballot printers, and along with the iPads and a lot more staff, what the goal here in Palm Beach County is to eliminate the lines. Since early voting began in 2004, we've always had long lines at early voting. And this last year, we had 14 facilities, and they just didn't prove to be enough because the legislature had cut those days in half to 8 days. Now what we have is more hours than we've ever had before. We had 96 hours available to us last year, and in the future going forward, we will have 168 hours that Palm Beach will utilize to the fullest extent. We'll be able to go to places like our downtown convention center and the fairgrounds. We'll put five or six printers out there, lots of people, iPads, and I think that we will be able to eliminate our lines.
Oh, that's fantastic. It's nice to hear some good news for a change on these matters.
Yeah, we're working on it.
Let me ask you a slightly more difficult question. And if you don't have the material at your hand, I understand. You can probably just talk in broad brush terms. What kind of percentages have we seen in the voting participation last few years?
Well, during gubernatorial elections, we usually don't peak above 50% here in Palm Beach County, which is very unfortunate. But during the presidential elections, we usually come to a level of just under 70% of the voters who are eligible come out and vote. So last year, during the general election, we had 870,182 eligible voters, and actually 605,268 total votes were counted, and that is a percentage of 69.56%. For the gubernatorial elections, if you look back traditionally, it's 47-49% turnout. So I think that the people really don't understand the importance of their state leadership, and that their legislative races are on there, and they have the ability to really impact the way that laws are established in the state of Florida by going out and voting in the gubernatorial election as well.
Well, certainly those people who've noticed Mr. Scott's governance style, hopefully they will be coming out and expressing their opinions on this Florida governor.
Well, I also want the people to know that not all of the laws that were passed this year were positive. You know, absentee ballots have become a tremendous importance in every election. They usually account for over a fourth of all of the voters who voted. So in the general election, we saw over 157,000 absentee ballots cast in Palm Beach County. And, you know, the legislature changed the law to say that if you want an absentee ballot mailed to any address other than voter registration address where you're registered at, you have to submit a new request in writing with your signature. Now, we think, the supervisors think, that it's going to tremendously impact the snowbirds and also the students. And there's nobody out there telling them that information. And I think that it is designed to target those voters to decrease the number of absentee voters that we will receive in the next 2014 election.
If you were counseling our listeners, should they have the same level of confidence with an absentee ballot that they would have with a personally cast ballot?
Well, if they follow the directions properly, I would say yes. And the reason why I say that is sometimes people forget to sign the outside of their envelope for their absentee ballot. Now, the supervisors successfully lobbied the legislature to say, hey, if the people don't sign it and it's before Election Day, we post it on our website. You can look at your status and it'll show you when your absentee ballot was returned to us. And if it says that you didn't sign it, we passed a law that will now allow us to receive an affidavit and a copy of a picture signature ID from a voter before Election Day. The deadline is the day before Election Day. We could put that with the absentee ballot envelope that's not signed, and we can now open the ballot and count it. in the past, if you didn't sign the outside envelope and we received your ballot, there was nothing you could do about it. We could not open that envelope and count your ballot. So I think absentee voters should be pretty confident. We are extremely careful in making sure that on a daily basis, all of the ballots that we're receiving are being accounted for, balanced, and counted. We start counting those ballots 15 days before each election. So the first election results that we always show on election night are actually absentee ballot votes and early votes that we already have. So we post those right at 7:30 during every election. So your ballot does count. You just have to carefully follow the directions.
I know there's occasionally you hear rumors that, well, they only count the absentee ballots if. And that's not really the case, is it?
No, it's not. Like I just said, we count the absentee ballots first. We keep receiving them throughout the election cycle. The law allows us to begin opening those ballots 15 days before the election, so then we're all ready to go. There's a new law that requires us to upload, to count all of those ballots and upload to our computer system all of the numbers. We just can't hit the totals until 7 p.m. when the polls close. And that's why we have such a quick turnaround on election night. Our first totals that we're showing on TV are from absentee ballots. So they're always counted first.
I see. Well, thank you so much. If our audience wants to double check their voting status, where can they go, either in person or online?
Well, certainly they can always call us at 561-656-6200, or they can go to our website, which is pbcelections.org, and on the right hand side there's something called voter information lookup. You put your name and your date of birth in there, and it will tell you your voting status. It'll tell you where to go on election day, what your polling location address is. And if you're voting absentee ballot, it'll tell you if you have a request on file. And when we receive your ballot back in the mail that's already voted, it will tell you if it has been received appropriately or if there is no signature, or it'll tell you what the status of your absentee ballot is.
Well, thank you so much. I sure appreciate your time, and we appreciate what you do to guarantee the integrity of our vote. Too bad every county doesn't have someone as hardworking as you. Thank you so much.
Thank you very much, and thank you for your work. I really appreciate your information to the public, and if I can be of any assistance to anybody out there, we work almost every day, and I'm very much interested in going and engaging with our public. Thank you.
Thank you, Ms. Booker. Bye-bye.
Have a great day.
You too. Okay,
thank
that
you,
was
Rick.
Ms. Susan Booker, Supervisor of Elections for Palm Beach County.
Thank you, Rick, for that really interesting interview you had. I couldn't help but note the discussion that you had on the integrity of votes, particularly early ballots that are cast. And we have a guest coming on now, Samantha Hope Herring. Samantha has a lifetime of work as a community organizer, working on advocacy, elections, grassroots campaigns. She's Walton County Democratic State Committee Woman. She's a Panhandle Coalition organizer, and she's also Bay County Legislative Liaison for the Democratic Women's Club. And Samantha has a very interesting story that she brings to us tonight that touches on this whole issue of the integrity of votes. Samantha, are you with us?
Hi, yes, I am.
Samantha, thank you so much for joining us. I know you and I have been talking for a couple weeks now, and you've got a very disturbing story coming out of your end of the state. Why don't you take a few minutes and tell our listeners what the story is all about and what's happened in the aftermath?
Sure. Well, first, thank you so much for having me on and bringing this information to the public, which I feel is obviously very important. We had a special election taking place in the Panhandle in House District 2, State House District 2, to replace deceased House member Clay Ford. And that election was made up of basically Escambia County and a few precincts that were in Santa Rosa County. And that special election was held on June the 11th. And we had a Tea Party, Northwest Tea Party candidate by the name of Mike Hill, who ran against a gentleman by the name of Jeremy Lau, who was a Democrat. And he, you know, basically was probably not even thought to have, the Democrat was probably thought not to have, a, you know, kind of a snowball chance in hell because it's a very red area of the state. But we had a grassroots group of people who got behind Jeremy Lau, and we worked very hard, tirelessly, to get information out in the community. And Jeremy's very much a moderate. And he had a lot of support, and suddenly he began gaining quite a bit of momentum. And we had some real energy and legs underneath this campaign. Needless to say, the day before the election, which was the 11th, as I mentioned, I got a phone call from someone who called to let me know that they had been contacted by someone who had voted for Jeremy Lau, and they had been notified by the supervisor of elections of Santa Rosa County that they needed to come and attempt to recast a vote because there had been a break-in at the SOE's annex office and the votes had been stolen. And that was the call I got the day before the election.
Votes were actually taken out of the commission, out of the supervisor of elections office.
That was the information that was provided to me by somebody, by an individual, by a voter. I was not contacted, nor was Mr. Lau contacted, by the supervisor of elections office. This was just given to me sort of word of mouth. And so on the day before the election, I took off and went down to the location where I believed the supervisor of elections would actually be. Her name was Pappy Villain. And attempted to reach her by phone. They would not give me her cell phone. So I drove to the annex building to go find out exactly what was this, you know, what exactly was this? What was going on? What had happened? And to get some more information. And the information that I, you know, was able to gather was very difficult, just so you know. I mean, pulling teeth is sort of an understatement. I left messages and went to different locations, and I finally was able to find the supervisor of election at the main building in Milton, Florida. I went there and had another campaign volunteer with me. We went in and spoke with her. She had the canvassing board member with her, and she advised me that there had been a break-in the night before and that two vault ballots had been or votes had been taken from the annex building. And I, you know, I asked her if there was any video coverage of that, and she told me that there wasn't. And I thought that was very odd because the office where I was speaking to her, above her shoulder was pictures you could see. It was a screen split into four, and it was surveillance for that location. And I asked her why there was a difference in the security policy for where we were and where the votes were stolen from. And she said, well, it didn't really matter. They were going to gather the votes, but there's only 35 votes, and it didn't matter anyway. And it was nothing to look at, nothing to worry about. You know, she's handling it. She was going to try to get most of those votes and drive out there and see if she could find the people herself. And I thought, and she said, and if you have any other questions, you need to call the sheriff's office. And I was just, to say I was mind blown is sort of an understatement. It's one of those surreal moments where you're going, is this like, there's not going to be a press release, you're not going to disclose this to the public, you're not going to halt the election and say, hold on, you know, we're not sure exactly what has taken place here and we can't proceed, you know, equitably for everybody if we don't stop what we're doing here at this point. And it just blew my mind. It really blew my mind that the integrity of the vote had so little value, just in the way the laissez-faire, you know, conversation for me personally. It was very, you know, kind of jaw-dropping. I didn't expect that.
Samantha, if I could just interrupt you here for a second. Now, you went on to county property looking for the supervisor of elections to confront her on this issue. And did you not find that there were signs for the Tea Party candidate actually on the property?
Yes, in fact, we took pictures of that because it was, again, part of the whole experience, which you're just going, is this actually, I mean, this is supposed to be a nonpartisan, you know, sort of safe place for people to come and cast their votes, you know, and there were literally, when I tell you, maybe five or six Mike Hill signs at the SOE's office, you know, I'm not joking. I mean, we took pictures of it, which I thought was very unusual and very odd, you know, right out the gate, to be walking into a place where there's supposedly just been this break-in, you know, in the middle of the night. And, of course, you know, I didn't go on to tell you, but we found out that there actually was surveillance video. We wouldn't have known about it, but I, you know, insisted on getting a copy of the police report. And when I got a copy of the police report, I was able to actually see where it said, you know, according to the surveillance, you know, suspect number one can be seen, you know. And then at that point, I, of course, was very much requesting, along with other people at that point, to see a copy of the video. And so we were eventually released a copy of the altered video to the Pensacola News Journal newspaper, which had endorsed Mike Hill. So, you know,
you
we're dealing with an all Republican
video.
Correct, it was an altered video.
So you didn't get the
entire...
No,
we have not had the ability to... I was told that it was an open investigation and that for that reason they could not release, you know, they could not release it. So, you know, that's, you know, certainly this law enforcement, you know, is under the direction of the sheriff there in Santa Rosa County. And, I mean, just so that I can point this out, I think it's an important component to all of this, virtually every elected official in that county are Republicans. And, you know, I'm certainly not trying to point a finger here, but I will tell you that, you know, this no-name candidate went from basically, you know, being nothing to suddenly having a real chance at winning this election. And we just found that, you know, it was a very odd occurrence, you know, and the response that came, I mean, two vaults, you know, stolen from the SOE's office, and the newspaper that endorsed, you know, the Republican candidate said that it wasn't political in nature. I mean,
Samantha, let me ask you a question. Now, some time has passed. Have you inquired recently what the status of the investigation is?
I have inquired many times. In fact, I won't stop inquiring, just so you know. I intend to find out. I mean, I'm not certain if you have seen the actual video, but clearly that video could be enhanced. There's no question in my mind. And we could be looking for people who have taken the vaults out. And so as far as I know today, I was told by Tappy Blaine, the supervisor of elections, that she does not intend to have, you know, any other – she doesn't intend to take any other action on this, that it's in the hands of the sheriff's office. The sheriff's office says that, you know, basically they're not intending to take any further action, that, you know, if there's any leads or if they're pursuing anything, that's part of their investigation. So the public is just sort of left out in the cold.
Let me ask you this. You know, in a sense, it's a question that arises from this whole situation. If we cannot count on the security of our ballot, what do you call that kind of an election? It completely destroys the democratic process, if you ask me.
Well, I had the sad privilege of witnessing it firsthand, and I have to tell you, in my personal opinion, it's stunning. The nonchalant indifference and sort of laissez-faire attitude of writing off the integrity of a vote, to me, is I mean, I truly believe, I don't care what side of the aisle you come from, I truly believe that that is indeed, you know, the greatest, you know, right that we have, the greatest privilege that we have here in this country, and to even have the attitude that, oh, well, there was only 35 votes in there. Well, we don't, and I'm just going to say this very frankly, we don't know that. I have not seen, I did request and have not been provided with a chain of custody of anything that was in there or was not in there. And as far as I'm concerned, you know, I think there was what we call an incurable uncertainty as to what was, you know, actually in those vaults. I mean, the fact that there were, we know that there were 168 votes that were never even mentioned on one of the jump drives, for example. That's very concerning to me. It's concerning to me that there were.
Yeah, let me back, Samantha, let me back up a minute. Now, you mentioned earlier that this was a race between a Democrat and a Tea Party candidate. And
correct.
That there was a lot of pressure on government officials to get the Tea Party candidate elected, correct?
That's correct.
And certainly
that has to do with the fact that they are all of the same party. You know, having an area where literally every elected official is a member of that same party, and there was this upset that was clearly underway at the point that this took place. So, yeah.
So you had the Tea Party candidate leading in the polls, and then the Republican candidate who lost in the primary, Ed Gray, a respected mayor of Gulf Breeze, he actually came out and through both his endorsement and contributions to the Democrat, Mr. Lau. Is that not correct?
That is correct. There was a very big primary. There were six candidates in that primary, and Ed Gray was thought to be the favorite. He was a very well-respected sort of moderate Republican who had a long history of doing public service and really operating in sort of a nonpartisan way. I mean, he was a moderate. And, you know, Mr. Hill, you know, he had a very aggressive campaign, and it was considered to be a very bloody primary. And Mr. Gray did come out and did make a contribution to Jeremy Lau, the Democrat, and also did say that publicly in the newspaper, unsolicited by us, by the way, he did say that Mr. Lau was the better candidate and that he was voting for him. So that happened on a Friday, and the break-in occurred on that Sunday, mid-morning.
Okay, so just so I can, you know, lay out a clear picture of what happened here, you had a Tea Party candidate who was greatly favored. You had the defeated Republican candidate come out and endorse the Democrat candidate. The person who did so was very well respected, and now all of a sudden the Democrat is surging in the polls, so this is not a slam dunk anymore for the Tea Party. Is that correct?
That's absolutely correct. And in addition to the you know, having the support come in from that area, you have to realize that Ed Gray was the former mayor of Gulf Breeze, and those are the three precincts affected where the theft occurred, you know, in Santa Rosa County. You know, that's where this happened. And so, you know, I don't know. I mean, my father used to always tell me you never speculate about speculation. But, you know, by the same token, this is, you know, this is one of those things that's just not passing the smell test for me.
There's also the saying that there's no such thing as a coincidence, too.
Right. Yeah, there you go. Well, and it's one of those things where, and I have to tell you, the thing that concerns me is here we are, you know, this election was June the 11th, and we're talking about two probably pretty expensive vaults. They said they're about 600 pounds, you know, and you can see in the video, somebody shows up with a dolly. That's not your typical, you know, that's not your typical guy out there seeking, you know, drug money or whatever. I mean, you know, somebody shows up with a dolly. Clean-cut looking guys showing up and, you know, very much target go in directly to the SOE area in this annex. There's many different little governmental agencies. They go directly for the vaults in the SOE's office. So clearly these individuals knew, you know, they had some kind of knowledge. I can say that because they certainly showed up prepared. That being said, you know, one certainly does have to wonder. I mean, about, you know, just the fact that here we are, you know, it's, you know, we're approaching a month out, and, you know, where is the follow-up? I mean, if you're a supervisor of elections, you certainly have an obligation to voters and those who've been engaged in the political process in that area to to come forward and to follow up and provide, you know, information and insight as to what in the heck has happened with these elements that have been entrusted to you.
Mm-hmm. Well, from an outsider's perspective, it would seem, hey, they won the election. What more is there for them to worry about?
Well,
but
I'll say this.
I'm just speculating.
Yeah. Sure. And you know, and we've heard that, well, there was just 35 votes. Well, according to who? You know, we've heard a different story now. We know there were 850 blank ballots. We know that there were technology components, hardware and software, enclosed in there. We don't know. I've not seen a chain of custody to know with any certainty as to the inventory of the materials that were there and what are missing today. And I just find it also very curious because I should not, nor should the public, have to go and track down in a pursuit to find out more information about something that affects the you know, integrity of our vote in this area, especially in the Panhandle, especially where all the factors that we've gone over today have, you know, been sort of, you know, put out in the public. I mean, it's very difficult to understand how something like this can happen in the United States of America in the year 2013. It's just difficult to understand.
Samantha, you know, when I looked at that video, I saw these guys who clearly not only knew right where they were going, but seemed to be in no particular rush.
Right. It's stunning. I mean, and I would encourage anyone who hasn't seen this video, I think it's very important. I don't care who you are or what county you're in the state of Florida, I would encourage you to look at this because this is something that everyone needs to see. And you can look at blackboxvoting.org is where you can look at the video. She actually has a copy of it posted there on that site. And you can look at it. It's an altered copy, but you will be able to see the video that the sheriff's office released. And that's available to the public. And you can, you know, make a decision for yourself. I mean, this happened literally, you know, in the middle of the night, the day before one of the most contested elections for a state house seat on the Panhandle in many years. So I think that, you know, that bit of information certainly makes one scratch, you know, if nothing else, scratch your head and wonder, where is the SOE on this? Why have we not had any follow-up? And I can tell you that I have followed up via email with her and basically been told, too bad, we certified the election. It's irrelevant if there's a open criminal investigation or not. We certified the election. And have a nice day. I mean,
there was something else that I noticed, Samantha, reading the police report on this, that the alarm system at the building went off at 2:19 a.m., but it wasn't until 5 hours later when an employee showed up for work that the break-in was reported to the police.
That's
what
correct.
Happened to those? Yeah, what happened to those 5 hours, and why was not the alarm answered? Did you inquire about that?
Well, I was asked. I asked about the alarm. First of all, you know, about the timing on the alarm. And I was told initially that the wires had been cut to the alarm and that there was no video. So we were just like, well, that's too bad. Good thing we know it was only 35 votes. That's it. We're all done here. Okay, move along. And I continued my questioning and said, you know, well, I understand that, but if there's an alarm system and it was cut, certainly there's a time that one can see that was done, that the wires were cut. Certainly there's a time that they were no longer online, right? I mean, certainly there's a time you can see that, because if you cut, I don't know if you know anything about that, but if you disconnect, there's a way to clearly know the time that, you know, there was a separation. So it was very shortly thereafter that we found out that, yes, the wires had been cut, and, yes, there was surveillance video, but that was not going to be very helpful because the surveillance video was, you know, what you've seen released, and there was no other information available regarding the alarm system. That was part of the active investigation, which they could not provide to us.
All right. Well, Samantha, this is indeed an absolutely stunning turn of events in this day and age, and we have to wrap it up at this point. But I want to thank you very much for coming on the show and telling
Absolutely.
Our listeners about this very bizarre tale. And please keep us posted on any updates that you have, because this is not something that I think needs to go away silently. And it's people like you staying on top of people like these is the only way we're going to get a resolution. So thank you so much for your hard work. And again, please keep us posted.
We'd love to have you back again, Samantha. Thank you.
Thank you. Y'all have a wonderful evening.
Okay. That was Samantha Hope Herring, Vice Chair of Walton County DEC, and the State Committee Woman from
Bay County.
Thank you so much, Renee. Okay, now before we bring Luis Cuevas on, one of our heroes of democracy, I do want to play this little spot from our good friends at www.mrsdd.com. MRSDD.com.
What is Legal Shield? It's total access. It's total freedom. Everyone deserves legal protection. And now, with Legal Shield, everyone can access it. No matter how traumatic, no matter how trivial, whatever your situation is, we are there to help. From real estate to divorce advice, identity theft, and beyond. Legal Shield has your rights covered. With Legal Shield, you'll be able to talk to a dedicated, experienced attorney about whatever you want, as often as you want, for less than $20 a month, no matter what happens. Legal Shield will have you protected and empowered to worry less and live more. Please visit www.mrsdd.com. That's www.mrsdd.com. Legal Shield.
And that's our good friends at Legal Shield, a sponsor of our show. So now, ladies and gentlemen, you know, we've had some wonderful activists now. Now, this is a special kind of activist. This is Luis Cuevas, a progressive push who helps candidates understand how to make this work. Luis, welcome, sir.
How are you?
Very good, my friend. Very good.
Excellent.
You know, you're a person who's been in the trenches for so long, who's helped so many people understand how to make this process work. Luis, look at what you see today. What's the state of our democracy, brother?
I think that we are at a time, at a junction here where things are getting a bit out of hand, and particularly because I believe that we're not focusing. There's so many things that are being thrown out at all of us on the part of the GOP, or I don't know what they, conservatives, what they call themselves these days. You know, will the real one please stand up? But it's getting we get somebody to say that they had an autopsy, and by now somebody please bury that thing, because it's, you know, it's really stinking the place.
I was just going to say, you know, they told us after that debacle last election that they completely got the message. All they've got to do is say with the same things they've been saying, but just say them nicer.
Well, the problem is that they don't know how to, because of the way that they are. Now, here is a little bit of a take that I have on this whole thing about the Voting Rights Act. That we have seen, and it is quite obvious that the conservative portion of the Supreme Court actually, you know, was throwing this whole thing back to the state, and obviously there is a racist equation there. But there is something else, perhaps. I mean, you know, let me put it, a cynical little guy. because what I see here is something else at work besides all that. And that is that we have a court where a majority is made up of members, passive or active of the Federalist Society.
Uh-huh.
And that is a very conservative legal body, or attorneys, judges from throughout the country gather to discuss matters of state. And what I see happening here is the push for federalism, old-style federalism, which, of course, is blurred a bit by the activities of the libertarians. People call the Republican Party the party of Lincoln. But it's not the party of Lincoln anymore. It's the party of J.C. Calhoun. See, it has changed. And what they are pushing is for going back to states' rights, to nullification, to segregation by legal means, if possible. And that is where you tie that up with the whole thing about shrinking the government to such a size that it can be drowned in a tub, if you will. That is what is at work right here, and that is terribly dangerous, given the fact that they are fermenting another part of the populace, and that is the individuals with the guns. So it's a very bad mixture that is being concocted here. And it's really sad that the Supreme Court conservatives are pushing in that direction. It reminds us also of a court right before the Civil War, where in 1857 the famous Dred Scott decision, which triggered the barbarities that we would later see. And here is very much a similar pattern. The difference is that in 1857 it was the abolitionists who were bringing the test case, and in this particular case here is the conservatives who brought a test case to the Supreme Court. And in both cases, yes.
I should have let you finish your thought, but I got to ask you this question. You know, you've got these guys basically kind of slowly creeping out of the closet with their racist ways. And, you know, mm-hmm. you got to wonder, when Rand Paul is asked, you know, is it okay for discrimination in a private restaurant?
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, he's weaseling his way out of it. You know, you got to wonder if between gerrymandering and ALEC money, if these mm-hmm. These recidivists and Confederates, essentially,
mm-hmm.
you know,
yes.
if they should somehow manage a majority in the House, and it, certainly actual voting may not have any role in this, but if they manage to do that, you got to wonder what kind of draconian, you know, pre-1890 of America is going to be sitting there.
Right.
Pre-18 Civil War.
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, it's. I think that you are getting a number of issues that are coming up together, and you just have to see. Supreme Court goes one way. Here's the House pushing another one, and here is the NRA pushing another issue, and it's all coming together.
The Texas explosion, right? An
mm-hmm.
unregulated industry, cavalierly just tucking explosives anywhere they please,
exactly.
citizens building right up to this. And what's the Supreme Court, what is the Texas legislature focus on? Limiting women's right to abortion.
Exactly. Yep. But you see, what they're doing is maintaining a public, a series of issues that they throw out at the public. And so, therefore, people's attention focuses on that. Progressives have a tendency, many groups, for knee-jerk reactions, and they go after these bones that are being thrown at them. not realizing that in the background, these people are quietly pushing all these things. And they have decided that they can't do many of these things through the National Congress. And so what they're doing is going through the state legislatures. And if you look at the political map that we have, it really is the old Confederacy that has taken over the Republican Party, of what was left of it. And that is something that essentially began with Goldwater, and then Nixon eventually manipulated it, got the old Dixiecrats, you see, and then later they were called the Reagan Democrats. But essentially the same thing, you know, they used to be the boll weevils at one time. But it's all these Southerners who then flow towards the Republican Party as a result of the Voting Rights Act of 1964. And they've been, since then, operating within the Republican Party.
Sure, and, wasn't that, Lewis, that was the famous Southern strategy that Nixon and Reagan used to win over the Southern Democrats.
Yes, yes. And so what now we have is that they are operating, in the system, and furthermore they have obtained the support of these billionaires, like the Koch brothers, and they're pushing these issues. Yet at the same time, you're looking at they're trying everything they can. When Christie recently has revealed, it came out in that book about the election, the last election, and Mitt Romney, but there's a little bit of there of a meeting of 60 billionaires with Chris Christie, and they wanted him to run for president. What's at play? Well, essentially that they need to have a northern face to what they're doing, because it would be just too obvious.
You've been around this political adventure for quite some time, my friend, and you've seen the dark days. You know what the desegregation fights were like.
Right.
You know where. Do these guys really want, how far do they want to go? What's your thought?
Well, essentially they can go any, I think that they are so desperate. The fact that a black educated man got elected, and then all the changes that you've had, that, we have had as a country, cultural, social, that have these changes that have really ruffled their feathers or more, and now the last bastion, the last thing that they have is control of women. They just simply need to get their hands on this and get the little ladies under check, because otherwise, what do we have? And get them, at home, and keep procreating, and have more white children. This is act of desperation of a dying breed of people,
Lewis,
because yes, sir.
I would love to have you talk a little bit more about progressive push. But I have to bring on our last guest, and I'd like you, if you can, stick around with us. And I think you might be interested in talking to Corey as well. She's a candidate for the Florida Legislature from the Vero Beach area. Let me go ahead and bring her on. And,
yes.
And Lewis, if you can,
sure
stick
thing.
Around. Thank you, brother.
Right.
Thank you so much.
Will do. All
Let
right.
me go ahead and bring on Corey.
Hello, this is Corey.
Hello, candidate Corey. How are you tonight?
Very good. Thanks. How are you?
Very good. You've got Rick here, news director. We've got Renee Shaker, associate producer, and our good friend from Progressive Push, Luis Cuevas. Corey, why don't you tell us what put you in a mind where you needed to help serve the people of Florida?
Sure. I grew up in Florida, And for the past 12 years, I've been working in Washington, D.C. as a federal policy director for environmental organizations, Oceana, National Wildlife Federation. And since I work daily with Congress and the administration, I've kind of seen how bad the situation has come with our Congress and our administration not working together, not getting anything done. The 111th and 112th Congresses were just basically fiascos, and the 113th is not doing much better. So I figured I would come back and run for Congress because I want to see things get better in Congress so that we can improve the lives of the middle class and the people of the 8th District and the people of Florida, and I am not seeing that in Congress.
If you were to say the top two or three items on your agenda, what would you say?
Protecting the environment, which is the biggest economic driver in the state of Florida and certainly enormously important to the people of the 8th District. I'd like to see us balance the budget in a sane way so that we are still investing in the future, education, technology, science, protecting our veterans, certainly not with sequestration, which is harming so many things that Floridians care about and need. And, of course, we need to be protecting Medicaid, Medicare, and Social Security. But in addition to that, I'm also very concerned about women's issues. I'm tired of women's issues being treated as second-class issues in Congress. And that kind of goes along with the Supreme Court ruling. The disenfranchisement of certain voters, the bipartisan extreme ideology that's taken over Congress, I'd like to see an end to all of that.
Excellent. For people who aren't familiar where the 8th District is, can you sketch that out for us?
Sure. It's Melbourne. It's along the East Coast. It's Melbourne, Cocoa Beach, as far south as Vero Beach. It includes NASA, Cape Canaveral. It's a beautiful part of Florida. It shoots out directly east from Orlando.
Corey, you've worked in Washington now for many, many years. And, you know, we are all more familiar than we want to be about the dysfunction that has gripped this Congress. Tell us a little bit about how your experience in negotiating the halls of Congress you think can make you an effective representative for Floridians.
Sure. In the past, Republicans and Democrats have come together to work on things, to protect the Clean Air Act, to protect the Clean Water Act, to pass bills like the Water Resource Development Act, WRDA, to pass farm bill, to pass appropriations bills. And depending on who's in charge, sometimes the Democrats were happier with the outcome, sometimes Republicans were happier with the outcome. But it kind of moved along, and it was about compromise and, you know, keeping the government going, keeping America on a track, moving forward. But the last two Congresses, they can't even get a single bill passed. I mean, they didn't get the farm bill passed. They're not getting WRDA passed. The House has been holding the Senate and the country hostage on fiscal bills. You know, over on New Year's Day, we almost went over the fiscal cliff in regard to the tax situation. It's very hostile. It's very antagonistic. It's ridiculous. And I think when I win, I mean, Bill Posey is the current congressman, and he is kind of an ideology guy. He only votes straight down the Republican Party. Votes with Paul Ryan, votes with kind of the extremists in the party. And when I'm in, I'm going to work a lot harder with Republicans and with Democrats to move legislation and just, you know, have adult, mature conversations, identify problems, identify solutions, and work towards it instead of just kind of going into a corner and adamantly saying absolutely not without even trying to find a compromise, which is what Congress has been doing.
You know, from where a lot of us sit, our view is that much, if not most, of the dysfunction in Washington is due to the extreme radicals on the right, the Tea Party in particular.
Mm-hmm.
Would you agree with that?
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah.
And as a follow-up to that, do you think that there is enough core camaraderie or professionalism amongst the remaining members of Congress to regain that sense of purpose and to come together and compromise, or has that been destroyed? Can you comment on that?
Sure. A lot of Republicans voted for the Sandy Supplement, which was the package that passed in January, I think it was, or early February, to give federal aid to people that were victims of the Superstorm Sandy in New Jersey and New York. And Republicans and Democrats came together and said, this is what it's going to take to rebuild this part of the country. These are people in need. These are communities that are hurting. And they came together and they passed it. The Tea Party voted against it, including Bill Posey, even though we have 100 miles of oceanfront in our district. So one bad day, we could be asking for help from other members of Congress. So there are still members of Congress that say, hey, there is a problem. Let's work together. We're Americans first. Let's just roll up our sleeves and deal with something. Mm-hmm. The Violence Against Women's Act, several Republicans crossed over and voted for that, even though Bill Posey, who is inclined to be more of a Tea Party member, voted against that as well. So there are members. I do believe, though, that we need to vote out the majority of the Tea Party representatives if we're going to get to the problems and actually start getting America back on its feet and going in the right direction. I think the only way to change Congress is to change it, and we need to get some of these members voted out of office.
I'm sure you won't find an argument for many of us on that point, but from a very practical standpoint, what we've seen is even more moderate Republicans, and in particular the House leadership, have basically been cowed by these radicals, and that there is the constant threat of being quote primaried unquote, where if you don't vote with the radical base, then we'll just primary you out of office in the next election season. How do you counter? Is that a real problem? And if so, how do you deal with that?
Yeah, that is a real problem. A lot of members that used to be more middle of the road or moderate or independent thinking have been cowered into, doing some ridiculous things and taking some ridiculous votes. And yeah, I agree that Boehner and leadership is probably at its weakest that I've ever witnessed. But I would say that, again, it's just that we have to vote these people out. And it's the responsibility of members of Congress and senators to educate their public and inform them, here's the issue. It's a little complicated. Let's walk through it. Let's talk about what happened historically. Let's talk about why we got to this situation. And kind of bumper stickers and rhetoric that's just used to inflame people and get them passionate and full of hate sometimes or full of intolerance – is not helpful. So when a member of Congress uses that as a tool to get elected or to gain popularity in their districts or with their, if your leadership with your members, and then all of a sudden it turns on them, then that's kind of the situation we're in. And people need to back up and just educate their electorate and say, I get it that the government, we don't, the deficit is a problem. It's not as huge a problem as we keep saying it is. We can address it by getting, more people back to work so they can pay taxes. There's a sane educational way for them to handle it. And I feel like until the Republican Party steps up and starts assuming this responsibility that goes with being in Congress, which is educating your constituents thoroughly, then they're going to be continuously under threat from kind of an ignorant, uneducated, extreme but large part of their party.
Mm-hmm. Ms. Westbrook, let me introduce Luis Cuevas to you. He's executive director of Progressive Push, and he trains candidates. Luis, do you want to make any suggestions or any ideas you want to throw to Ms. Westbrook?
One of the things that, good evening, nice to meet you, at least on the phone. I hope that we can meet soon.
Yep.
One of the things that I've been looking at, and I know that you have recently been moving towards this campaign, I looked at your website.
Mm-hmm.
And I'm looking at, right now one of the most viable means of getting the word out there is the social media. Recommendations that, you know, one of the things that we need to look at, you know, looking at your website, you need to get that moving pretty quickly and make it very active. If you don't mind my saying this, but it's something that people want to look at, what you want to do for your district. You know, it's for example, a campaign that says, you know, reboot the district, get it going again. What is it that you see that needs to be done for your district? Because that's what the voters want to know. A voter will come and say, what is it that you want? You know, you're running to do what exactly? But they're not thinking in terms of, you know, the House of Representatives in D.C. They're thinking in terms of what are the problems of the county, these counties in your district, and what are you going to do for them? You know, essentially, you also have a number of veterans in that district, retirees. They also want to know. So, you know, rather than put a laundry list of issues in a website and, you know, and stash them there, people don't really go read over them. Focus on, you know, what needs to be done. Focus on what's wrong with the county. With X or you know, and how do you want to approach it? It's all about what to do, what needs to be done. It's going to be fix something, create something new, or repair something that needs to be repaired. Focusing on that, your voters are going to be much more open to listening to you. You don't want to get into a debate over the national issues there if they're not important to your district. And they might be a sideway for your opponent to try to distract you because that's what they do, you see. They want to corner you into their type of debate. They want you to answer the questions they ask, and you don't want to do that. You want to answer the questions you would like to be asked.
Well, I think what I heard Corey say earlier is that, you know, Medicare and getting the health care money down to Florida is vitally important.
Right.
And the environment. Mm-hmm. I mean, I think these are two really strong issues that could resonate with
Absolutely.
The voters in District 8. Yeah.
And Congressman Posey voted against or voted for both of the Paul Ryan budgets, which cut Social Security, Medicaid, and Medicare by 8% starting and then progressed. But, Louise, I very much appreciate that advice because I have been working on, like, you know, explaining to the voters that Bill Posey is voting against them. His votes are actually harming them, everything from the environment to women's issues as well as jobs. He has done nothing to bring jobs into the district, and a lot of his votes are actually cutting jobs because we have a lot of federal government jobs, from NASA to the military installation to Fish and Wildlife Service. So I'm just right now pointing out that his votes are hurting them, and then I have some great ideas for bringing some jobs in and for protecting our district, which, and of course, bringing jobs in. So I really appreciate that advice, but I do need to get my website up to par and start, you know, putting all this down. I have a very active Facebook page, which is easier to update, you know, on the fly. So, but I do appreciate that.
So, Louis, let me ask you, based on what Corey just said, is that an effective strategy, pointing out how her opponent is harming residents
Definitely.
Of District 8?
Yes, they need to realize what's going on. They need to see how he's a what do you call it, a rubber stamp. Essentially, that's all he does. He's not representing them. He is representing the people who actually are not making any changes. You know, what was the last job he created? You know, and the way that you just, you know, replied to me, that's, you know, the energy that you need to put in there. That's right what you need to put in your website. That's right how you need to approaches. That's a very good style, and that will work. You see, that's what people expect. When they see somebody who comes out and does that and looks at them in the eye and says, you might not agree with me, but I will do right by you. You see.
Let me ask this question as a follow-up. You know, given the fact that Corey has had extensive experience in Washington, knows the system, and knows how to negotiate it, applying that experience to the specific issues of environment and job creation and getting money down to Florida, can that work in her favor?
It definitely can. The one thing is to, you know, when the you cruise through the district, taking notes, having a staff that, you know, takes videos, see things that are not doing, you know, are not going well. At times, even when you're knocking on doors, and that's going to be the most effective thing that you can do. Knock on doors. Start early on that. You see, it's time for GOTV, getting out the vote.
Mm-hmm.
It's not waiting until a few months before the election, because the Republicans are doing it right now. That's how they get these campaigns going, because they start very early. And the thing is to get your name around the district. Have an organization in every county that is mirroring your organization at the main base. You see, that you have field directors and volunteer directors, et cetera, in every county that you have, and that they're in continuous communication with you. And as you tour those districts, what's wrong here? What hasn't been fixed? Talk to the people about that. Sometimes it helps if a few neighbors are talking and you say, wait, did somebody do anything about these potholes here? You see,
mm-hmm.
and the thing is that they will say, well, you know, this is a district thing. You're repping, you want to be a representative in Washington, but hey, yeah, something needs to be done about these roads, you see. And maybe get a few of the staff and go over to City Hall and say, hey, you know, these people need help here. They will notice. They will remember.
You see.
They know who cares. And that is something that money cannot buy, that relationship.
Right. And sometimes, I totally agree, and that's why we started the campaign is really early. I just filed in April, but door-to-door, meeting people, getting into the community, absolutely, totally important. And I think, again, that my skills from knowing D.C., like, it's like, okay, you voted against the WERDA bill because you thought it was expensive. Did the normal people, do regular voters know how much money was in there that could have possibly gone to saving our Indian River Lagoon, which is our beloved lagoon, which is struggling like right now? So I make these connections that people might not normally know. We haven't passed the transportation bill. That could help with potholes. Why haven't we passed that? You know, like to explain to people the connection between the national level and how it can help or hurt us at home.
That's the way. Yes, yes. What are the demographics of your district? Do you have a...
Go ahead. I'm sorry.
No. I mean, the distribution, the demographic distribution in terms of ages and by race.
It skews older, the population, and it's very white. I'm not sure where we rank, but I think we might be one of the least diverse communities of districts in the state of Florida. It's... in some ways, if you look at some numbers, the Indian River County is one of the wealthiest counties, but we also have some poverty. So it's a mix, but it's not that mixed, if that makes sense.
Mm-hmm. All right. Yeah, I understand. So essentially, you see, you take a look at that, and that's how you tailor a campaign. And you look at that, and I guess you make the connections between all these things that people don't realize. And obviously, if you have a population of elderly people, there's going to be social securities, like Renee mentioned, social security, Medicare issues. But there's going to be Medicaid issues also for the poorer people. Right. Let's see. So, and then in terms of the youth, where do they go? How to help them? You see, and that's, you know, what right now one of the biggest issues is the student loans.
Absolutely. Yep. And then the young people, not only are they going to be drowning in debt if they're not right now, and I talk to young people all the time between the age of 22 and 30. They can't get jobs. Mm-hmm. How do they pay back these student loans? It's a real problem, and what Congress is doing to them is ridiculous.
But let me tell you one thing, too, that most people don't know, and that there's a lot of seniors who are still paying college loans. You know, believe it or not, but people just say, "What?" You know, yes, because they, you know, their loans got so high, and they accrued in time, and so whenever you don't pay, then you get more of the loan in there, more in debt.
Yeah.
And so before people know it, it's like the old song, 16 tons." You see, a day older and
more
deeper
in debt.
Yeah.
You know? Exactly.
But those
and
are things that they
become.
Will understand. Yeah.
Uh-huh.
But if there's anything that we can do, and if you need to, have a consultation or so, we can definitely help you with that pro bono. Do you have a campaign already organized?
If we can
help you with that, and we can also help with putting you up on our website and giving you with our Twitter accounts, we can also help you
spread the word.
Spread the word, yes. And there's a hashtag PFlorida, PFLA, that you can use to reach folks in Florida in the progressive crowd and get your word out about your campaign. And especially if there are some of them in your district, that will help to bring them around if you need volunteers. So, you know, that type of thing is something that really helps. And, that doesn't cost you a thing.
Corey, let me
I really appreciate it.
But, Corey, let me interrupt for just
it
a second.
Help. Sure thing.
Corey, why don't you go ahead tell folks how they can get in touch with your campaign to support it. Obviously, your credentials are superb. You know your way around Washington. Your heart's in the right place. How can people get in touch with you? How can they get in touch with your campaign? To give us your Facebook address, too.
Great. My website is CoreyWestbrookForCongress.com. I have an office in Vero Beach, if anyone's in Vero. And I have, if you want to email me, it's info@CoreyWestbrookForCongress.com if you have any suggestions or input. And my Facebook is just, Corey Westbrook for Congress at Facebook. And I'd love it if people would like it.
We will. We will.
Thank you.
If you were to tell people what you hope to do for the Indian River Lagoon, which has gotten into such a state that even nationally people are talking about it, what do you see as the first steps that need to be taken to help restore Indian River Lagoon to where it needs to be?
The Indian River Lagoon is one of the most biodiverse lagoons in the world, and they're actually talking about it internationally as well, watching this beautiful lagoon just go into massive crisis so fast. I mean, we have problems with septic and sewage runoff. We have problems with fertilizer and pesticides and chemicals from golf courses and people's yards. But really what we're trying to do right now, and scientists in Indian River County are working on it, is to pinpoint exactly what is causing the pollution at what places so that we can put our limited resources into resolving those problems. The nexus to the federal government is we can use the Clean Water Act and we can use state revolving funds, loan money, to try to improve our sewage system. We could be building retention ponds to, cut the river and the lagoon a break. We can do education and outreach and say, switch from this product to this product. We can improve the Clean Water Act nitrogen total maximum daily load runoff standards, which Florida and the Florida legislature and Congressman Posey have worked to weaken over the years. We can strengthen those There is so much we can do, and we need to be doing it now. We need to be getting federal government assistance. We need to be using our scientists, and we need to get the community involved, local county commissioners, people, and make it a number one priority, because everyone in the 8th District loves the Indian River Lagoon. And there's been over 100 manatee deaths. We've had multiple dolphin deaths. We've had, you can't even fish there. I mean, historically, it's like a paradise, you know, for windsurfing and fishing, and just people spend a lot of money to live right on the Indian River Lagoon. And, you know, it's affecting property values. It's affecting tourism. We need to do everything we can to get that lagoon as healthy and as fast as possible. I have a lot of ideas how we can leverage the federal government and work together with the local community.
Well, thanks so much. And I want to thank our good friend Luis Cuevas of Progressive Push for all your efforts. Luis, why don't you give people the information on how to get in touch with Progressive Push to support your organization?
Thank you. Yes, you can reach us at info@progressivepush.org. You can follow us at on Twitter at Progressive Push. And we are also at the Florida Progressive Push on the Facebook, and Progressive Push also on Facebook. So they can contact us any one of those ways, or they can write me to Luis@progressivepush.org, and you can reach me directly.
Louis, well, thank you so much. And
Corey,
I'm so delighted you could join us. We had a really interesting discussion going there. We'll have to get together and take it to the next step. This was good.
Absolutely. I really appreciate it. Renee, Rick, and Luis, this was great.
Yeah,
Corey, do you have any events coming up?
Not until August. We have a lot of stuff going on in August, but please check out my Facebook page because we promote everything, and there's great places for meet and greets and activities, so that would be great. If you could follow my campaign on Facebook, that's awesome.
And keep us posted as well, Corey. We'd be delighted to get the word out in any way we can.
Thank you.
You know, one last thing I was going to ask you, Corey. You know, you've seen Washington. You've been on the dealing with congresspersons. You're thinking about going back. You know, a lot of people out there are going to say, you really want to go back? Do you have the stomach to deal with some of the childlike pranks that seem to occupy so much of Washington?
You know, I get that a lot. People in D.C. and elsewhere ask me if I'm crazy, you know, because the people who know Congress say, are you crazy? And I'm like, well, I've tried writing letters. I've tried the grassroots. I've tried, you know, using the science and as an advocate and with these amazing nonprofits. And I feel like it's not getting what I want to see done and what I want to have accomplished. So
well,
now I'm going to try
it
from this angle, and we can see what happens. And you know what, too? I think from having seen it for so long, nothing surprises me anymore. With their behavior and their votes and their immaturity sometimes and the ridiculousness, I just kind of take it in stride because I've been exposed to so much. So hopefully that will serve me when I'm in Congress, that I will just see it, accept it, and move past it as quickly as possible.
Well, you know, thank you so much.
What's that old expression, you go, girl?
Oh, thank you.
Okay, folks, well, you all have a good night. And people,
thank
don't forget
you,
to tune in next week with Progressive News Network, bringing you the finest voices from the progressive Democrats that you can hear. There's good news. There's good things happening because of the good people out there working every day.
Thank you. Good night.
Good night.
Good night.
Good night.
I don't want your millions, mister. I don't want your diamond ring. All I want is the right to live, mister. Give me back.
Good night. We'll see you next week.